Welcome to the Studying the Bible podcast, where every Thursday, Pastors Dylan Dodson and Brian Androsian study a book of the Bible, verse by verse, to see what is being communicated and how we can use it to grow in our relationship with Jesus. We pray that today's podcast can help you grow just a little bit closer to Christ.
Welcome back to our online Bible study through the book of Esther. This session will be in Esther chapter 2. Now in Esther chapter 1, we see that the King Xerxes, or King Ahasuerus, throws a big banquet to get ready for his big battle against Greece. He also divorces and leaves his queen for calling Queen Vashti at the end of the banquet to come and really expose herself to his nobles. She says no. So a massive decree is kind of sent out to make sure that no other women get the same idea as Vashti, that they must obey whatever their husbands ask of them. And so we're going to read what happens next in Esther chapter 2. And as we do, I want to begin with this question. What should we do when we don't know what to do? Right? Because often in life, things are not always black and white. Like theoretical examples, you know, should you steal? No. Should you tell the truth? Yes. You know, it's easy to say what you should do. But in life, there are a lot of situations where the right thing to do is muddied and it's complicated and it's not always easy. And in Esther chapter 2 and throughout the book of Esther, we're going to see that people are, these characters are often find themselves in really hard situations. What would we do if we were them? That's a good question to ask, and we'll kind of come to maybe a better understanding of how to answer that question at the end of Esther chapter 2. And so in Esther chapter 2, starting in verse 1, after this massive banquet, he divorces the queen. A decree goes out that all the women in the kingdom may need to make sure they obey their husbands and not do what Queen Vashti did. Then says this, chapter 2, verse 1. Sometime later, when a King Ahasuerus' rage had cooled down, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what was decided against her. Now again, we're not told how long later is in verse 1, although in verse 16 it tells us that Esther came before the king in the seventh year of his reign, which we'll see here as we go through this chapter, which is likely puts the events of chapter 2 about 4 years after chapter 1. And so what this means is that chapter 2 takes place after losing the war with Greece. We know historically Persia goes attacks Greece. They are unsuccessful. And so he's probably mad, not just about what happened with Vashti those years ago, but really what's happening with the war, the humiliation, the losing. And so he remembers Vashti, what happens to her, and here's what happens next. Verse 2. The king's personal attendants suggested, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king, that the king appoint commissioners in each province of his kingdom so that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem at the fortress of Susa, put them under the supervision of Haggai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the women, and give them required beauty treatments. Then the young woman who pleases the king will become queen instead of Vashti." This suggestion pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So to be clear here, this is not some beauty contest where they get the women together to find the most beautiful. And if you think, I don't know, Miss USA or Miss World, that's not at all what is happening here. What's happening here is shows us, number one, the absolute power the king had to do whatever he wanted to do, and also just the severe evil of what actually is going on here. See, what would have happened is that young women would have been taken out of their homes, their communities, their families, and they would be put into the king's harem, which they would be a part of for the rest of their lives. So even if they were not chosen as queen, they were stuck in the queen's harem for the rest of their lives, and so they would go through these various beauty treatments and things to get ready for their one night to sleep with the king. And what would happen is, after you sleep with the king, you cannot marry or sleep with any other man after the king. So no children, no family. It's a very tragic thing that is going on here. So he takes all of these women to find out who's going to be a king. It really destroys all of their lives. And then in verse 5, it says this. In the fortress of Susa, there was a Jewish man named Mordecai, son of Jar, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite. He had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the other captives when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon took King Jeconiah of Judah into exile. So these verses show us two important things. One, that this exile took place about 120 years before the current events. If historically, the kings of Babylon, where things took place. The Israelites have been in exile, have been overrun by the Babylonians and now the Persians for about 120 years when these events begin to take place. So Mordecai, again, as it tells us, was taken into the exile, which shows us that the Jews had been in captivity for a very long time by the time we read about the events in Esther. At the same time, we do see that some of them were still trying to somewhat hold on to their Jewish identity, even in the midst of exile and having to do things that were outside of their control. So they've been in exile for a while. And the second thing that's important to note here is the name Mordecai. Now, for us, it might not mean much, but for the original Jewish audience, this was a big deal. In fact, it was a big red flag, because as a Jewish readers, you would know that Mordecai is not a Jewish name. Mordecai comes from Marduk, which was a Persian god. And so as we're going to see, that Mordecai has really radically assimilated into Persian culture in ways that would have been disobedient to Jewish laws and customs. So, of course, we're all impacted by our culture, but clearly he would be involved in certain things that would go against what God would have asked the Jews to do. And on top of that, he lived in the fortress of Susa. So he didn't just live in any city, but he had clearly climbed the Persian political ranks. So that being said, here's what we know, that Mordecai was anything but a set-apart Jew. He was fully assimilated into Persian life, which would have been a big deal for faithful Jews. You would be, Mordecai, red flag, why would he do this? Again, as we read this chapter, remember the question, what would we do when we don't know what to do? It's easy for us to say, well, he shouldn't do those things. Or if we think of modern examples of followers of Jesus who have compromised, and of course, certain things in their faith, and of course, we can be honest about where that goes wrong, but we also have to be honest about the human element. That Mordecai, these Jews were in a very impossible, if not difficult, situation. And so over time, many of them began to assimilate. Doesn't necessarily mean it's okay, but hopefully we get some sympathy for what they might be going through. And I think, again, it's worth pointing out that as followers of Christ, we can do the same thing. It's easy for us maybe not to see it because we kind of live in our culture, and so we're in it. We're not outside of it, so it's hard for us to look on the outside. But there are many ways, if you're a follower of Jesus, that you have assimilated to the culture around you, from the things you wear, things you watch, what you say. And many of these things are not necessarily inherently wrong, but they can be. And so it's a good thing for us to step back and maybe ask ourselves, where have we over-assimilated into our culture in ways that might dishonor God? And so Mordecai, a fully assimilated Jew, even has a goes by a non-Jewish name, then says this in verse 7. Mordecai was the legal guardian of his cousin Hadassah, that is Esther. So a different name. Hadassah would be her Jewish name. Esther would be, as we'll see, her non-Jewish name, because she had no father or mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure, and it was extremely good looking. When her father and her mother died, Mordecai had adopted her as his own daughter. So again, Esther is also a Persian name, meaning star, likely taken from the goddess Ishtar, which again is another red flag. She also is a Jew, going by a non-Jewish name. Not a good thing. And then verse 8, when the king's command and edict became public knowledge, that is, when he was searching for another queen, and when many young women were gathered at the fortress of Susa under Haggai's supervision, Esther was taken to the palace and to the supervision of Haggai, keeper of the women. So a lot of women would have been taken in this, most likely against their desires or wills. While it is true that many of their needs were taken care of, or at least supposedly taken care of, which if you're in a rural, poor context, that's nice when you're struggling to eat, struggling to get by. At the end of the day, their life would have probably been very lonely. They would have been taken away from their family forever into the king's harem. No kids of their own, no husband of their own. And so while there maybe some of their physical needs were taken care of, at the end of the day, I'm not sure really any of the women, especially after they lived in the king's harem, would have said that this was actually a good trade. So it's a very sad thing. In fact, this really, if we're going to put modern language on what's happening here, this is sex trafficking. Right, this is taking women against their will to exploit them for their bodies. And of course, it still happens today. Now, one of the things about sex trafficking that's interesting is all of us, Christian or not, would say that it is a wrong thing to sex traffic. Slavery is wrong. Sex trafficking is wrong. Now, if you believe that, I think we also just need to be honest that if you engaged in pornography, yet say sex trafficking is wrong, you don't actually believe sex trafficking is wrong. Because the vast majority, a great majority of women involved in pornography have been sex trafficked or have had things happen in their lives where this was the route that they had to go just to survive or get by. And so again, there's a difference, to be honest, between a struggle or a weakness with pornography, understanding that it is evil, it is vile, it disregards women and men, and it is wrong, and trying to get help to ask through the Spirit, through community to overcome it, or there's a difference between that and to just privately consume it on your own. Maybe you know it's kind of wrong, but hey, you're not really hurting anybody because you're not doing anything. To engage in pornography is actually to engage in sex trafficking. And so if you are disgusted by this, we have to ask ourselves, are we honoring God's design for sex, or are we, in a 21st century context, doing exactly what Xerxes did, even though we didn't have his power? Because like we saw in Esther chapter 1, power is not the only thing that defines evil. Like, all of us are capable of it. And so if we're against sex trafficking, we also should be against pornography. So that's what's happening here. They're being sex trafficked, and it's a really sad thing. But it says this, verse 9, the young woman pleased him and gained his favor, so that this is Esther to Haggai, and gained his favor so that he accelerated the process of the beauty treatments and the special diet that she received. He assigned 7 hand-picked female servants to her from the palace and transferred her and her servants to the harem's best quarters. Esther did not reveal her ethnicity or her family background, that she was Jewish, because Mordecai had ordered her not to make them known. Every day, Mordecai took a walk in front of the harem's courtyard to learn how Esther was doing and to see what was happening to her. So again, let's be extremely clear here. Esther did not have much of a choice to join the harem, right? She didn't have a choice. She was picked. She had to do it. You can't tell the king no. But yet once she was there, and this is what makes Esther so hard, as we talk about in Esther chapter 1, understanding it, we do see that she seems to be a very willing participant. We see that she does what she could do to get Haggai's favor. She hid her Jewish identity. Again, might be just because Mordecai told her to do so. She didn't know any better, but she does it. She would have had to have broken many Jewish laws and ways that they would honor God, and likely through her diet and things she was would have done in the harem to gain favor. And yet she still does them, right? She was not a set-apart Jew at all. Which, again, is the difficulty. What should we do when we don't know what to do? The hard part is we're not told why she does what she does. We're not told why Mordecai does what he does. We're not told their motivations. Their motivations could actually be good, or they could be bad. In fact, as we will see, Esther and Mordecai deserve our sympathy, right? Because they're in a really impossible situation a lot of times. And yet, we can still point to unfaithful decisions. This is why I would just point out why people's stories matter, right? People's stories matter because it's really easy to judge people's decisions. Well, that was right or that was wrong without having to know their background, what they went through, and how they ended up doing what they were doing, right? And I would place this before you. It's my conviction. Sin is sin, but I think at the end of the day, the Gospels are quite clear. Scripture is quite clear that God cares about our intent. And so making a wrong decision with good intent is better than making a wrong decision with bad intent. In fact, if I were to, not that you have to pick, but if I were to lay before you, if you're a follower of Jesus, what's more important, truth or love? Telling people the truth or loving people? If I had to pick one, I would suggest to you, I would submit to you that Scripture says that love is the most important thing. Paul seems to quote it in 1 Corinthians, or say that in 1 Corinthians 13, the most well-known, you know, wedding verse, you know, love is greater than all these things. And if you're a clanging gong, if you speak all these things and you don't have love, you're a clanging gong, so well, nobody is going to listen to you. And I would submit to you as followers of Christ, if we pray for people, if we believe and trust in the Spirit, that yes, we should be honest, yes, we should tell the truth, but at the end of the day, love is the most important thing. Compassion is the most important thing because it's exactly what God had for us. And so, yeah, we see here some things outside of their control, some things are their control. They seem to make unfaithful decisions. We're not told their motivations, which makes this hard, but I think it should give us pause to step back to know Hester's in an impossible situation. And some people in your life and in my life are in really difficult situations. Instead of just judging them for what they've done, we should love them and point them to Christ. And so she gains favor, and then here's what happens next in verse 12. During the year before each young woman's turn to go to King Ahasuerus, the harem regulation required her to receive beauty treatments with oil of myrrh for 6 months, and then with perfumes and cosmetics for another 6 months. When the young woman would go to the king, she was given whatever she requested to take with her from the harem to the palace. She would go in the evening, and in the morning she would return to a second harem under the supervision of the king's eunuch Shazgaz, keeper of the concubine. She never went to the king again unless he desired her and summoned her by name. So essentially, the women are prepared for an entire year for one night with the king, for the king to sleep with her, and then rarely, if ever, would she see him again. I mean, again, this is a very tragic thing that's happening. And then verse 15. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter. When her turn came to go to the king, she did not ask for anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the women, suggested. Esther gained favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. So again, when it's Esther's turn, she only takes what Haggai suggested. Now, why? We are not told. Was it because she did not care? She was only doing what she had to do? Was it because she trusted Haggai to know what she needed because she wanted the king's approval? Again, she's in a possible situation, but since she's in it, you might as well get the king's approval if you can. It seems that she did so intentionally. She was always gaining favor, so it does seem to suggest that she was doing things intentionally to try to win Haggai's favor and ultimately the king's. But again, we don't know why she does what she does, which makes this book difficult. And then verse 16 to the end, here's what happens. The last part we'll read today. It says, she was taken from King Ahasuerus and the palace in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. Verse 18, the king held a great banquet for all his officials and staff. It was Esther's banquet. He freed his provinces from tax payments and gave gifts worthy of the king's bounty. Now again, what makes this difficult and maybe frustrating is we are not giving any other details other than she won the king's favor and became queen. We're not sure what all happened, what happened in the process, how did she become queen? We don't know how long did it take. It's just eventually she's chosen to become queen. But again, now we run into difficulties. Again, the question is, what do we do when we don't know what to do? I mean, especially if you're an ancient Jew reading this, and you're up to chapter 2, verse 18, where we'll end off this session. The question is, how do you feel about this, right? Because as a Jew, she slept with a man outside of marriage, and he was a Gentile. Of course, this was outside of her control, but it stinks that it happened, and both things would have been forbidden by Jews at this time in their history. So this is not good that this happened to her. And yet, we're going to see later on that because she is queen, that God uses her in powerful ways that would not have happened if she was not queen. So is it a good thing that she then became queen? But if it is a good thing, then you become into the question, do the ends justify the means? Which I would submit to you is not a good principle to follow. I don't think it's a biblical principle because God's people should desire to love him and honor him. We shouldn't do bad things in order to try to make good things happen later. Again, to be fair, I'm not saying Esther did this. She's put in a situation that's outside of her control. But the ends justify the means is not a biblical concept. But yet, that seems to be what's going to happen later on. Again, we are given no perspective on what God or anyone else thinks. We're only told what happens. Yet, this ambiguity, I would say, also gives us hope because life is full of situations where circumstances make our decisions difficult and murky. Maybe not to the same degree as Esther and Mordecai here, but you and I face decisions every month, every week, where we're not always exactly sure what to do. In fact, I'm going to read this long quote, and then I'll give you three reflections as we end this session. I want to read this quote from Karen Jobes in her commentary on the book of Esther as she reflects on this passage. Here's what she says. She says, this episode from Esther's life offers great encouragement and comfort when we find ourselves in situations where every choice is an odd mix of right and wrong. Only God knows the end of our story from its beginning. We are responsible to Him for living faithfully in obedience to His word in every situation as best we know how. And even if we make the wrong decision, whether through innocent blunder or deliberate disobedience, our God is so gracious and omnipotent, which means all-powerful, that He is able to use that weak link in a chain of events that will perfect His purposes in us and through us. Esther may have looked back on this episode of her life with shame and regret, or she may have looked back on it with a clear conscience, knowing that she acted as wisely as she could, as she knew how at the time. In either case, every one of us also has both kinds of episodes in our own lives. Esther's story shows us that we can entrust them to the Lord and move on. And so to end, I'm going to give you three thoughts on Esther chapter 2, verses 1 through 18. Number one is this, that faithfulness is not accidental. It's not accidental. If we are not careful, we will assimilate more and more into our culture, which is not inherently wrong unless the things we are assimilating into or becoming more like are against God's wisdom and the ways that we can honor Him in response to the gospel and what Christ has done to us. Faithfulness is accidental, not accidental. Mordecai, again, all he knows is exile. It may not have been a lot of conscious decisions that led him to grow up and go through the political ranks and to do things that he would have to do, certainly against his custom to actually get there. It might have been a lot of innocent, small decisions that led there. And the same is true for you and for me. If we want to faithfully follow Jesus, it does not happen by accident. We need to be in a community that can encourage us. We need to pursue God. We need to ask His Spirit to move in our life. That if we want to follow Jesus, it does not happen by accident. Faithfulness is not accidental. It takes intentionality. And if we're not careful, we will drift away. We will certainly not accidentally drift toward God and the things of God. Second thing I would say as we read this, to remind ourselves that grace is better than judgment. Again, to be clear, truth matters, honoring God matters, but at the end of the day, we should treat people the way Jesus treated us. And you might say, well, at the end of the day, when Christ returns a second time, He is going to judge, which is true. But His first reaction towards us, or His first offer towards us, is not judgment. It's grace. It's forgiveness. It's love. It's invitation into His kingdom. In spite of what we have done, not because we earned it or deserved it or did anything to make God love us, or like we can't do any of those things. God in His grace extended love and mercy and forgiveness to us first. And so as a reflection, I think we should do that for others, and we should pray and we should ask that our love for others, that might be the thing that turns people to the Lord. Not telling people all the reasons that they're wrong if they don't know Christ, that certainly does not seem to be very effective. And so remember that grace is better than judgment. And then finally, to encourage you, I want to encourage you with this. Your past does not disqualify you from God's purposes. Again, we don't know. As the quote from Karen Jobe says, Esther may look back on these events with shame, or she might have looked back on them saying, hey, I did the best with what I could in the situation that I was in. Regardless, if you think of the situations in your own life, maybe there are times where you made the best decision possible. I'm sure all of us, there are certainly times where we did not make a good decision, and we knew we weren't making a good decision, even at the time. But God's grace and His mercy is an invitation to remind us that He can still use us, that God, through the book of Esther, is going to use a lot of evil decisions for His good and for His glory and for His name. And the same is true for you and for me. And so if you're listening and you're watching to this and you're thinking, man, I've done so many things, unlike Esther and maybe Mordecai, where I have intentionally gone my own way to dishonor God, you need to know that that does not disqualify you from God's purposes, that God can pick up our pieces, that through Christ He invites us into his kingdom, and with love and grace, He says, that is my son, that is my daughter. So again, faithfulness is not accidental. Grace is better than judgment, and your past does not disqualify you from God's purposes. And that's certainly what we're going to see as we continue through the book of Esther.